Okay, I think we'll get started. My name is Karen Blomquist, and I currently live in Oakland, California, after being a pastor, teaching at seminaries, directing theological work at the ELCA and the Lutheran World Federation, etc. What I'm going to be sharing with you this evening are some reflections, and I changed the title to "What Kind of False God is Reigning Today? How Can We Counter This as People Whose Faith Is in a Different Kind of God?" In many ways, this is kind of a beginning of what I hope to continue and have a more participatory discussion on Friday, but anyway, we'll see how that goes. And the jumping off point here is what Luther said, that a God is anyone or anything in which people place their trust, on which people's trust rely. And in recent months, I realized, that is a lot of what's going on. Although it's more than attached to just a given person, and not just a U.S. phenomenon. In fact, at the beginning of the Radicalizing Reformation Project, I was responding to a sociologist who was talking about the forced migration going on in Europe, which is really huge, you know, in terms of Europeans trying to come to grips with all of that. And the image that came to my mind then was, it's like two tsunami waves coming, clashing together, you know, with the rise of populism, certainly various kinds of populism in this country as well as in Europe, and then the migration of lots of people, and so, you know, blaming it on those immigrants and you know, all the kinds of things that come together when those tsunami waves clash together. In talking about false gods, I think just in a very short-circuited way to indicate, throughout biblical history, the people of God were tempted to and often did follow false gods, which is why cautioning against idolatry is such a major theme throughout the Bible. Now, together, today, accusing people of worshiping idols, which typically they think of, oh yes, I'm worshiping the god of another religion, is likely to only result in defensive reactions. Of course I'm not worshiping other gods. You know, I don't believe in them. In fact, I, if anything, am against all those other gods that my neighbors or others might be worshiping. But in an ironic reversal, the reigning false gods in our time are those who are demonizing those who practice other religions. It's almost a flip. You know, so the demonizing of Muslims, for example, and those who might, you know, who do practice other religions. So what has occurred to me again and again is that we live in a very chaotic time when one who rules over all is declaring and acting as if he alone is God. And one could think of this as collective, because it's not just attached to one person. But thinking of that one person who will go unnamed here, whatever I say is true, and certainly the compromising of truth, despite what the evidence or facts might indicate, follow me and what I promise. You know, blindly follow me. No matter what the results or lack thereof, I alone will assure the absolute idolatry of power, of wealth, strength, and uncountable military might. And if you follow me, you too can succeed as I have. I will conquer the forces of evil, will make you feel secure. I will keep America safe again. Just believe in me. Refrains that those of us who live in the States anyway probably heard again and again, probably echoes of that up in Canada too. You know, these crazy people south of the Canadian border. These cadences, I think, are familiar to people of faith. In a sense, there is a refrain in Scripture of follow God no matter what, no matter what sufferings, or, you know, how long, oh God, you know, to refer to Michael's Bible study in the last hour. But in these days, we are beckoned to follow a false god, for whom acquiring as much wealth and celebrity status as possible is all that matters, with little attention to what will serve the common good politically, especially those who are most vulnerable. An arbitrary god who regularly changes his mind, surprising us with ever new atrocities clothed as blessings, with missing lies as if they were truths. So the reigning false god today is one characterized by policies of hardness, toughness, and defeat of enemies. And there are certainly plenty of passages in the scriptures that can be selectively drawn upon by hardliners who want to depict that this, in fact, is how God is. But overall, depicted in the Bible is a compassionate God who suffers with the people, redeeming and reconciling, bringing hope, not fear. Now, we may be drawing on moral principles rooted in our faith for critiquing and resisting various proposals or tweets that come from what is currently reigning in the U.S., especially those that draw upon certain racist, xenophobic, or misogynist assumptions. Indeed, resisting issues and how they interact or intersect with each other is important, which is why I think a lot of the resistance movement that's been happening in recent months, and the intersectionality of different issues, is really important. That's important but not sufficient. And certainly there's a lot of resistance based on justice principles and justice struggles. But I would suggest that these in some ways don't go far enough, because something deeper is at stake. Namely, the whole set of systematic assumptions which function much like a religious system. To put it bluntly, because we are confronted with one who claims not to be a politician, but who is acting at times as if he is God, an arbitrary God with autocratic tendencies. Politics as normal no longer reigns, nor do the usual ways the religious and political realms have interacted. Believe me, we are told again and again, and those enamored by him blindly follow at emotionally driven rallies that are much like religious rallies, with religious words added to give legitimacy to such Christian battles against the forces of evil. And of course, those forces of evil are especially people of other faiths and other lands. And unfortunately, this is also what happened, this lashing out is also part of what Martin Luther engaged in, and therefore must be critiqued in that regard, and we'll get into that tomorrow. Playing to people's emotions is not new, but unfortunately has been common in the arsenal of some religious and political leaders, both in the past and today. Stirring up mass emotions, but offering little in the way of actual policy proposals to make people's lives better. So, I want to suggest and have us play around with or consider in our minds that underlying these outbursts is a way of ordering our lives, an ideological ordering that is extensive in how it permeates our society and world today. It's often called, with a highfalutin label, neoliberalism, and by that I don't necessarily mean to connect it with liberalism, as many of us probably would want to identify. But this is how two writers, Ajar Sangri and Rafael Chapa, have described it. They call it the supermanagerial Reich. Interesting, this article was published November 7th, 2016. Mm-hmm. So a day before, you know, who was elected. But what they maintain is the basic aim of neoliberalism is to free the market through tax cuts, deregulation, reduced public protections, etc. And the problem under neoliberalism is that these kinds of market relations and principles are extended to every facet of society, from the economy itself to the state, including all the ways we might define human beings. Citizens become consumers, and humanity becomes human capital. The earth is exploited for economic profit, etc. I mean, this part of the whole scheme of neoliberalism, which seeks the extension and protection of this logic into all arenas of life, and which is why many theologians recently have talked about this really is centrally a theological challenge, because theology has to do with the whole. You know, how does the whole, how do we see the whole that's operating? And I think in terms of what's going on politically is that this is reflected in how politics becomes another form of market transaction. To succeed in politics, one simply needs to master the art of the deal. And not surprisingly, our current president sees himself as the dealer maker in chief. Now, this is where I think an important kind of connection from Lutheran theology or Luther's own Odyssey could be brought in. This, because this kind of deal maker or transactional logic or bargaining with God has often been countered by faith traditions. But at the heart of the Reformation that Luther initiated in 1517 was justification by grace through faith, which we touched on yesterday, which countered any kind of works righteousness or trying to make a deal with God, as well as all the ways people's fears are manipulated, whether by through the buying of indulgences back then in 1517, or by all the other kinds of false promises that are holding people captive today. Making a deal or attempting to win at the expense of those who are vulnerable breeds distrust, lack of compassion, and disconnectedness, especially those who are different from me and my desire to win and to get ahead and to, you know the kinds of things we were talking about in the Bible study. Endless competition against others under this way of operating is a governing mantra, which then reigns over all of life and destroys political life as we know it. So democracy, unfortunately, and I think we have lots of evidence in recent months of the fraying of democracy, democracy is reduced to its most transactional structure. And this is a quote from the two people I referred to before. Neoliberalism achieves a feat that the great revolutionary and reactionary movements of the 19th and 20th century never achieved, based not on a claim to democratic legitimacy, but on a kind of naturalism. In other words, there is no alternative. And maintains its citizens and workforce in a state of insecurity and anxiety, unquote. Anyone who takes seriously the threat of a newly empowered reactionary right must take seriously the role that neoliberalism has played in laying out the red carpet for its arrival. We must come to terms with the fact that we have already been living in a form of deeply destructive authoritarian liberalism, neoliberalism, for nearly 4 decades now. Like mid-1930s Germans, too many are quite simply comfortable with the rolling slow-motion horror that has been going on for a while. By focusing only on the threat of our homegrown Hitler caricature, we have failed to notice the facts right in front of our faces. The uniquely parallel structures, the same winners, the same losers, the crimes, the human degradation. Again, according to these authors, we are already living in our very own cruel 21st century super managerial Reich. Now, I would want to issue a little bit because I think one has to be very careful about drawing a lot of parallels with what we're going through today and Germany in the 1930s. But at the same time, I think we've experienced a kind of wake-up call. And therefore, beginning with what I said yesterday, I think what is needed is faith that is more public, rooted in what began in the Reformation, which, as I suggested yesterday, was a chaotic time in the 16th century. Martin Luther came to view the institutional power dominating society and people in the 15th century as a theological matter threatening salvation itself. He responded to people's fears and captivity by proposing a much different kind of relation with God. Through justification, the justice of God breaks in and fragments the dominant system. So the question I want us to consider a bit is, why haven't people of faith woken up to the need to challenge publicly what is going on from out of the heart of the faith we confess? I think some have been aroused, but it's often the society around us, and I think Christians need to join not only with other people, other faiths, but people of no faith, and saying, yes, how do we counter some of what's going on? But my concern is, how do we theologically frame this also, so that for people of faith, we're not just saying, oh, well, we're doing what everybody else is doing. Yeah, we are doing what everyone's doing, but our basis for doing that in terms of the long-term resistance is rooted and grounded somewhere else. I could go on and on, but I'd rather try to lay this out not only for the purpose of the tape, but also so we can have a good discussion among us. But let me conclude with this part. Spiritual traditions have much to offer in framing what is required. These include, first of all, prophetic stances that hold power accountable to truth. Secondly, community building that affirms the assets of local communities. And thirdly, practices that encourage careful and hospitable listening and presence as people heal from wounds inflicted by demagogues. Now, I think a lot of this is happening in local communities. It may be that we want to talk about some of what's happening in the communities that you come from. But again and again, I've been feeling in recent months that this is the real democratic political activity today in local communities that is occurring. And this is also what faith-based communities may be doing in society, where in some ways this kind of neoliberal logic has gone mad. in our day. Faith communities long have been nurturing people with an alternative worldview than what we in the U.S. are confronting today. But this needs to play a more public role and become pervasive, even to those who discount religion playing a constructive role amid today's crisis. Let me put in one more thing. I think, in addition to saying that, I think mainline Christians need to be more bolder and not just kind of giving things over to the religious right. I'm not by that suggesting we need to ramp up the volume and trigger reactions on the other side. Because I personally get a little bit annoyed with some of them, and of course in Oakland where I live there's lots of, I mean every day you could go to some demonstration or resistance, and I'm sure down there where you live, Carol, too. But so it isn't just a matter of how can we be as nasty as the other side. But I think the question is we really need to learn how to talk together and talk across those boundaries. And it occurred to me in coming up here that one of the visions I have for Holden, and it's probably what some of us have experienced here in the past, is that Holden might be a place where there might be dialogue across such boundaries, and we're learning to talk together can occur. You know, not just in a, you know, someone comes to a session and says, oh yeah, but, you know, in a very disciplined kind of way, you know, the learning to talk together across those boundaries, because more and more I hear that people are feeling that, for example, those of us who are in the Bay Area, are probably, I mean, California is a very blue state. You know, it's like, well, what about, you know, the red people live in red areas? Not everybody's Democrat or to the left in California either. But how do we really engage? And I think right now we are living in an extraordinarily polarized society, at least in the U.S., where even trying to talk with somebody who's a family member will go to the other side. The interesting thing is in October, when my late husband was in San Francisco in the hospital, his night nurse said, I actually voted for Trump. You know, and she could not say that out loud in San Francisco because, yeah, but it was, she'd come from the South and she, you know, they had, I'm not sure everything that transpired in that conversation, but she felt she could confide in Bill about that. And but I think for the most part, you know, how people voted, you know, and again, not that everything's related to what they vote, but how we talk across those boundaries is I think a real struggle. And how might that occur in a more disciplined way here at Holden? And I'm not just thinking session, but, you know, for example, if there even could be, you know, a week-long kind of thing, and you know, with a real intentional effort to bring together people whose perspectives are quite different, and finding common ground in between that. So anyway, that's more than enough to get us started. There's a number of things I wanted to just lay out for this recording, if we could talk more about that.
Well, let me put in a snarky question here. And then, aren't you asking us to do an impossible task? Because you started out by talking about false gods, right? Mm-hmm. And now you're saying, how do we talk across to people? Well, I mean, if you have a false god, what other dialogue can we have than one of polemics? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it can't be a very amicable discussion because, after all, I'm sorry. I mean, my goodness, you've got a false god, so nothing that you have to say really has much credibility as far as I'm concerned. So, mm-hmm. Now where do we go?
Stir it on the door. Hmm? Stir a little bit of warm manure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm certainly stirring something.
Adding that tail and the importance of dialogue, in some ways it didn't quite connect with a lot of other stuff that was laying out about. But I think 30 years ago, I tried to look at, theologically, at what was going on with white working class folks. In some ways, this is the kind of stuff a lot is coming, and the way in which individualism, victimization, and privatization was functioning. Well, first of all, as a parish pastor, I wouldn't come and say, oh, you're worshiping false gods. And certainly that's not the beginning of any kind of dialogue. No. But what I'm trying to say, so that would not be the theological or much less, certainly not the pastoral approach that one would take. But if in fact one is looking at alternative systems here that people have in a sense bought into, then I think one does say there is a clash between what is prevailing in our society today and what in fact the biblical accounts are about. So in that sense, it's a long-term kind of thing. It's not a matter of say coming in and saying, oh yeah, you're worshiping a false god. But I think as people of faith, we need to look at, for example, a lot that's happened in the last few months, at least in the West.
The prophets did.
Pardon?
No, the prophets did.
Well, yeah. But it's a different kind of false god probably than they were. But you, if you look at the worship of success and wealth and whatever that is regularly attached to the biblical outcry against.
I don't think it's that different. I mean, we in Canada as well, I was trying to figure out why would people in the States vote for Trump? And I think some of the conclusions we're reaching is Trump was somewhat secondary. That was what was really there was his slogan, right? Make America Great Again. Mm-hmm. And they voted for Trump because they thought he would be able to do a better job of attaining that goal than Hillary Clinton would. But in some senses, and of course some of the things he proposed would do, build the wall and all of that. But the real God in all of this is that illusion, if you will, make America great again, just as the prophets in Israel would rail against those who would, want to say, make Judah great again, make Samaria great again.
Back to the good old days.
The good, right. Back to the good old days.
We lived in bondage.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yep. The Egyptians heard it.
So that in that sense, we are battling the same kind of mm-hmm. false god, only the content is different now. It's not.
I think you're right. I don't know that there's a certain personification, but that something else I read about that the part of the genius of this Make America Great is you can choose what that means. What does it mean for you to say America Great? I can think of one thing and somebody else can think of a different way. It's so open-ended that it allowed for, I think, the 50s or whatever it may be, but that's part of the genius. And so it wasn't simply, so it was a kind of a sales process mm-hmm. rather than policies. And so I agree with that. I don't think it's particularly a person who does embody certain aspects of that. I think there are other functions going on. And which is what you were saying too about a couple of things in my mind. But that idea of going, why did you bring us into the wilderness? We had meat in our pots when we were back in Egypt. So there's some of that, whether going back and looking at the 2008 and you were not good enough, Obama, so therefore let's look for something else.
Mm-hmm. When we're trying to cross these boundaries with each other, I think about some interfaith sessions that I've attended. There was one it was Holden on the road, and I don't remember why, but we had some interfaith sessions, and there was a Sikh from Cal Lutheran University there, mm-hmm. who's a professor, and mm-hmm. he had these interfaith sessions, and it was so great to talk to him and for him to talk to us. And what I thought was amazing was, I thought it was all about us learning about him. And one of the things that he mentioned after several days of sessions was, he couldn't believe how many divergent views all of us, quote, Lutherans had. Everybody had their own kind of opinion about the discussion. So that sort of opened me to him when he expressed that. But I had no idea that I was so lacking in information until he started talking, and I guess he sort of felt the same way. And
I can't think of his name now either, but he is actually, in the religion faculty, one of the most popular teachers of Christianity to students, because he's coming from outside, but how do Christians look? Mm-hmm.
But when this fellow first came to the university, I think I heard a rumor that other folks were afraid, like maybe parents were afraid, well, I can't send my kid to that school because, you know, he'll teach them the wrong thing.
I think it's got also that they put certain aspects about that of the kind of postmodern view of how, which is kind of neoliberal. We define our reality, mm-hmm. and there was some of that in previous administration, but that's kind of a Ayn Rand. Mm-hmm. Liberal, we are the ones who create reality rather than, and it doesn't really matter what happened before. So I don't know much about geography, I don't know much about history. That's kind of become a mantra that's not important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because I think a lot of what's been picked up or what's come out in the open in the last few months is stuff that's been brewing for a while.
Right.
That's why this quote, you know, this is not a totally new phenomenon, but it's like, it's all of a sudden, you know, it's glaring, you know,
well,
especially
George
some
Lakoff,
of the...
George
the,
Lakoff says that too, some things about...
Pardon?
George Lakoff, if you're anything
yeah,
from...
Yeah, yeah,
talking about different, some world, different world views of
yeah.
looking at things.
Yeah.
And one's been, when you become frightened, you like a little bit more structure.
Yeah.
Maybe what's happening next, and we're not always comfortable with the ambiguities mm-hmm. that often mm-hmm. come.
Well, I think it really is the whole phenomenon of lots of people feeling, oh, yeah, you know, all these groups are getting a chance now. What about my chance?
Yeah.
You know, and therefore, the, you know, back to the way things used to be when they were more homogeneous. And I think unless some of that can be, how do we engage that and address that? I think is a key kind of challenge right now. And I think the church or faith communities are uniquely equipped to deal with some of that.
I think we also have to raise the question, think about some conversations I have with my daughter and her year in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but with a very diverse group about privilege, and we as who we are as Lutherans need to understand mm-hmm. and confess our privilege too. Mm-hmm. Since it's, I know I have some, I've had some real benefits by who I am and in as a white male, and, you know, basically middle class, and have gotten some places where I might not have otherwise. So we need to be aware. I think part of our dialogue needs to be certain emotional cue on our part, that we need to be honest with ourselves in order to be able to listen to the other. I missed an opportunity today, I confess to you. Early this morning, somebody at the table before breakfast said that he voted for Trump. And it was kind of, but I'm thinking, I wish I would have said, oh, tell me more. Mm-hmm. It was an opportunity that I missed. I suppose I could go back and try to pick that up, but that was an opportunity right then to engage in that.
Yeah, because otherwise we're just the sound bites of, oh, you voted for Trump, well, therefore I'm not going to take you seriously.
Right.
But how do we really understand the pain? And that's where the 3 points I was making toward the end, how do we really understand that in a more significant way? Now, I don't know if Holden can become that place. I mean, I think through the years, you know, this has been a place where a lot of, you know, movements, social justice movements have been fueled by, for a lot of people, et cetera. And so people that are more on the right might say, well, that's a little bit of a strange place. So I don't know if Holden Village can be that.
There was a dominating conversation, but there are some, I can't remember how long it was, I participated, it was up at Seattle U, in a conference on how, and it came out of the Roman Catholic, but it wasn't, they were the impetus, but it was an ecumenical conversation of moral conversation around salmon and water. And we were, so how do you have a moral conversation? And that was one of the struggles, was how do you do that within a context? And first of all, it has to be a safe place. And maybe for us, we find Holden safe, but someone else may not find that true.
Yeah, there'd have to be some careful laying of ground rules and whatever, and a sustained conversation, not just for an hour, and then people, you know, can raise issues and they'll get solved.
But, well, it does seem as though people here assume that folks are like-minded, and they really aren't. You know, they might tend to be a lot more liberal, but one of the things that they've always encouraged here is a diversity of opinion. And in order for that to work, people have to be willing to listen, and they have to be willing to ask the questions. And lots of us aren't really ready for that. I know that when somebody that I'm trying to share information with is more knowledgeable about their stand than I am about mine, say I don't know all the facts, I just know what I know, that I'm not sure that I can carry on that conversation. I don't feel equipped to carry on a conversation. No.
Right.
But Holden thinks that we should be encouraged. I mean, Holden is a sort of historical Holden thinks that we should be able to have a conversation, I think.
No, there have been some very, very difficult conversations here. I remember, this was probably in the 70s or 80s, Rosemary Ruther was up here and she did a Vespers that was exorcism of the demons of corporate America.
Oh.
And my husband was the village, I think Elmer Witt's time.
Back in the 80s.
And believe me, there were some fires in the village to put out that night because, you know, there were some corporate leaders here. And I think to really... Now, the interesting thing is, I think to some degree in the early days, Holden was modeled on what's, you know, the whole Evangelical Academy movement in Germany, which is a place where people gather for 3 or 4 days, and it might be in business, education, whatever. In other words, it's a mixture of theologians, of practitioners, of leaders, and some of the prominent ones. And there have been some very rich discussion, you know, and I'm thinking back when we worked on the Economic Life Statement in the ELCA, and we had one of our hearings at a church, basically, where a lot of the movers and shakers and Wall Street worshipped. And so three of us, I was staff, and then two, you know, people who knew a lot about business ethics were there, and they assumed, oh yes, we have to really, you know, talk in their language. Well, they wanted to bare their souls, because they, you know, their sense of feeling captive to the bottom line, to you know, whatever, and it really switched things, because we didn't, you know, we thought, oh yeah, they want to, you know, talk about how big business is operating, but that wasn't at all the, you know. So I think sometimes we sell short the fact, and I'm using even the language of economics, selling short. You know, we don't realize.
Better than athletic imagery.
Pardon?
Better than athletic imagery.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's another trinity.
And so, how to set that? So, going back to your initial, and it wasn't just a snarky comment. You know, I think that how we deal with the way in which false gods have us in their grip too. You know, it isn't just a matter of saying, oh yeah, they're worshiping false gods. But I mean, the way in which...
I think that would be where I am as Lutheran anyway, because the battle is for my heart.
Right.
Wherever I am. Whether it's, I name it as a bottom line kind of thing, or if it's my power in my household.
So it is... Both, it is us together. It isn't us versus them, that they're the whatever. And so, you know, that sense of captivity is when we share it.
So how do we, I think about that, job as a proclaimer, a preacher, a pastor, but how do we as a church raise that into question? How are you a prophetic preacher in terms of calling out our shortcomings in terms of our faithfulness to God? So that's kind of a biblical understanding, kind of that broad sense of what we mean by the Christian view of God. But how do we call that out even in our conversations? We're not Paul. Can't preach like Paul. What's that song? Pray like Peter. But we're not going to go stand in the Acropolis.
Yeah, although, I mean, I think it's open for question if Paul really was a great preacher or not. And certainly, if you look at his letters to the Corinthians, he wasn't always successful.
That's true.
But I well, I mean, I think some of this, what I try to do as a pastor and point that out in preaching is to recognize that the gospel, right, and the way in which the gospel constitutes a community of faith is already a politics, and it's a very different kind of politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I keep pointing out to our folks, right, people in my congregation, is the celebration of the Lord's Supper is a tremendously political act, right? And it is here too. I mean, the notion is, it's Christ's table, and what? All are welcome, and
a grain of exclusion,
and there is no exclusion, and there's no assessment in terms of, well, you know, if you're on church council, you get to come forward first, and you get to have as much bread and wine as you want, and, you know, the three-year-old kids, since you're basically useless as far as organization in this community goes, if there's something left over, you'll get that. Or, you know, we don't say, the big givers come forward first, and you cheapskates, you get left, you know, every, you know, everyone the same for them, welcome. I mean, that's a tremendously strong political statement about how do we live together and how do we treat one another. And so to say, well, okay, you know, we do that for, if you will, 1 hour on Sunday. Right? We say, go in peace, serve the Lord. Let's take that up there. Right? How can you work that kind of politics into your family, into the place where you work, and so on and so forth, right? I mean, and in that sense, it's not so much being prophetic as it is being subversive. But I think in many respects, that's kind of how God's reign and rule works. It's a very subversive
kind of thing. That's very consistent with what I try to put in this this book, which is subversive practices of being church, because I think over the long haul, and Eucharist is key in that. But how do we, you know, practice again and again and remind people that that's what, I like the way you're using politics, because I think that, oh yeah, it's a different way of being in the world. Yes, we are embodying a politics.
Is it, and thereby it becomes a different way of ordering your house, which is economy. So your different way of looking at the world. I remember talking about a little bit of what you said. I heard that Carl Sandburg was in an interview, and he was asked, what's the ugliest word in the English language? And he thought about it for a moment, and he said, exclusive is the most ugliest word for him. Exclusive.
And I mean, just one more thing, that kind of subversive, and again, the gods and all, and you're right, Karen, it goes back, I mean, I think that the difficulties here in my alma mater, University of Chicago, is to blame for this, I mean, Milton Friedman, right? And it's not just, but in Canada, Naomi Klein, right, disaster cap, and the whole thing is the way late corporate capitalism works, and it was first tried out, you know, by Milton Friedman and company in Chile and then other places. I mean, what you basically do is devastate an economy. And then, right, you get rid of any kind of social safety nets or whatever that work for people, for the vulnerable, all the kinds of regulations that are put on anything, whether it's business, industry, environment, and that, and you simply let the laws of the free market rule. And it's disastrous. But that's the system that the West has bought into. That's globalization. Yeah. That's something, quite frankly, that needs to be resisted.
Yeah. When about 25 years ago, when I lived right near the University of Chicago, and I heard there was going to be some, I forgot what the forum was, but it was three of the Nobel laureate winners in economics. And don't ask me who, I bought it off. But it was a velvet-draped dais that they were sitting behind. And of course, it was all these graduate school students, mainly in economics, that were filling the room. It was like entering an altar to a foreign god. I mean, I felt like this interloper there. Yeah. But just seeing how they were reverencing, you know, because these were their gods. They won Nobel laureates. So, your reference there.
I mean, if you're looking for the, you know, the prophets of the salt of the false gods, it's the Lord of the Lords.
Yep.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
See you outside.